You're listening to Clinical Conversations again. This is a Journal Watch podcast, and it's for the week ending April 30th. This is podcast number 85. I'm Joe Elia. For links to earlier offerings, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. And for a detailed look at what's new in clinical medicine, aim your browser at jwatch.org. This time, we talk with J. David Spence on his attempts to lower homocysteine levels and thus diabetic nephropathy with B vitamins. First, here's a summary of the week's top clinical news. Perhaps most important this week was an Archives of Internal Medicine study suggesting that clopidogrel suffers from interference by all proton pump inhibitors, not just omeprazole. Researchers examining claims data found that patients taking clopidogrel and a PPI concomitantly were at twice the risk for rehospitalization. Now, here's something that you may already have suspected. Women whose mothers had hyperemesis during pregnancy are more likely to have it themselves. Examination of a Norwegian database was the basis of the research published in BMJ. However, it's not known whether environment or genetics is to blame. Next, the elderly, whose immune systems often respond only weakly to vaccines, will have a quadruple-strength flu vaccine for the upcoming season. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices has issued advice on using the stuff in MMWR. Briefly, it's for people 65 and older, but not for those with allergies to egg proteins. Finally, if you're doing brain exercises to ward off Alzheimer's disease, we have to tell you that a National Institutes of Health panel doesn't think that such exercises, or anything else, has enough evidence behind it to expect results. At least not yet. Those with supporting data, or data of any kind, please step forward. That's the news for this week. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Vitamin B lowers homocysteine levels, and on the theory that lower homocysteine levels would translate to slower progression of diabetic nephropathy, our guest this week randomized almost 250 diabetics with a diagnosis of diabetic nephropathy to daily B vitamin supplements or a matching placebo. After about 2.5 years, the glomerular filtration rates among the B vitamin recipients unexpectedly had declined more than among the placebo recipients. In addition, the composite secondary outcome of myocardial infarction, stroke, revascularization, and all-cause mortality also favored placebo. Dialysis requirements were the same in both groups, however. As our conversational partner, we have the senior author reporting these results in JAMA this week. Dr. J. David Spence is director of the Stroke Prevention and Atherosclerosis Research Center at the Robarts Research Institute, and he is also professor of neurology and clinical pharmacology at the University of Western Ontario in London, Canada. Welcome, Dr. Spence.
Thank you.
Were you prepared for the treatment to do worse than the placebo?
Not at all. We were flabbergasted. In fact, when I first saw the results, I thought we must have the randomization code backwards until we saw that the B vitamins indeed lowered homocysteine levels, which was the intent, and so the randomization code wasn't backwards.
This research effort was part of a larger look at the homocysteine theory of atherosclerosis. Is that right?
Yes.
What are the factors that may be causing these things that we can address?
Yeah, well, I reviewed these issues in Lancet Neurology a couple of years ago. What many clinicians don't understand very well is that strokes and heart attacks are very different. And so when the HOPE investigators, the HOPE-2 trial that was run out of McMaster University in Hamilton, reported in the New England Journal in, I think it was 2008, the vitamin therapy they used, which was essentially identical to what we used in our study, significantly reduced stroke by 23%. They concluded that because there was no reduction in myocardial infarction, this reduction in stroke must be the play of chance.
Uh-huh.
That's because they were the principal investigator is a cardiologist, and he doesn't understand stroke.
And you do.
virtually all myocardial infarctions are due to occlusion of a coronary artery by plaque rupture, and the thrombosis is secondary to the occlusion. So calling it coronary thrombosis is really sort of a misnomer. Mm-hmm. And cerebral thrombosis is a term that I think should be tossed out. Most strokes are embolic. They either result from atherosclerotic emboli from proximal arteries, such as the internal carotid. And those are two kinds of emboli, basically. It's white thrombus, which is platelet aggregates or chunks of plaque. Or they are red thrombus, which is fibrin polymer with entrapped red cells that embolizes from the heart or from deep veins in the leg through a Peyton-Freeman ovale. And homocysteine is a clotting factor. It significantly increases the risk of deep vein thrombosis, retinal vein thrombosis, sagittal sinus thrombosis, and quadruples the risk of stroke in atrial fibrillation because it's a clotting factor.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very likely that treating homocysteine, at least in people with normal renal function, with these high-dose vitamins that we used, will probably reduce strokes. And in fact, that's what we found in a reanalysis of the VISP trial, the Vitamin Intervention for Stroke Prevention study. The VISP trial was published in JAM in 2004, and the principal results of the study, the intent-to-treat analysis, showed no benefit of these high-dose vitamins. But when we reanalyzed the study, excluding patients with significant impairment of renal function and excluding those with B12 deficiency who were receiving injections of B12 in both arms of the study, in that reanalysis that was published in Stroke in 2005, we found a significant reduction of strokes, heart attacks, and death, cardiovascular death, and a significant reduction of strokes and heart attacks with high-dose B vitamin therapy. Now, I think an important issue here is that these are high doses of B vitamins. So we used 2.5 milligrams of folic acid, 25 milligrams of B6, and 1,000 micrograms of vitamin B12. An ordinary one-a-day vitamin will contain something like 6 or 10 micrograms of B12, not 1,000. And it will contain 0.4 milligrams of folic acid, not 2.5 milligrams. And these B vitamins are water-soluble, so they are renally excreted. And my interpretation of our recent results in JAMA is that these vitamins may be toxic in patients with renal impairment because they're renally excreted and their levels build up to very high levels. And that's in the levels of folate and B12 are in the online supplementary table. Now, if you take together these results in JAMA, which showed harm in patients with diabetic nephropathy who had a fairly significant impairment of renal function, together with the VISP, what I called efficacy analysis, which showed benefit in stroke patients excluding those with renal failure, what I think our results are telling us is that high-dose vitamins are harmful in people with renal failure.
Mm-hmm. And your patient group actually had stage 2 or 3 on average renal failure.
Yeah. The baseline GFR was 70% of the patients had a GFR, 80% of the patients in the placebo arm had a GFR less than 60. Mm-hmm. And the mean GFR was 51 in the placebo group and 57 in the high-dose vitamin group.
And what's the normal GFR?
Oh, around 100.
And so taken together, those factors both studies would argue that there was some toxicity from the vitamins, but it's only in a group of people with nephropathy, and you were afraid that people were going to misinterpret your results as saying that you shouldn't be giving B vitamin supplements, but in fact, some people need them.
Well, yeah, the key point about all this is that people with vitamin B12 deficiency should not be stopping their high-dose oral B12 on account of this study. Because they don't absorb B12 very well, and they may need high-dose vitamins. And in fact, Sally Stabler's group in Denver reported a few years ago from a dose-response study in elderly people with serum B12 levels in the lowest quartile that you need 1,000 micrograms of B12 to achieve adequate absorption, and that's why we chose that dose for this study. Another issue that's really very much underappreciated by physicians is that vitamin B12 deficiency, meaning metabolic B12 deficiency as opposed to a low serum B12.
Mm-hmm.
Metabolic B12 deficiency is extraordinarily common. It's about 20% of people above age 65. And the big problem is that the serum B12 does not measure active B12. It measures total B12. And Helga Refsum and others recently published in Clinical Chemistry a paper showing using methylmalonic acid levels, which are the specific way to diagnose metabolic B12 deficiency, that in order to be 95% confident that a patient does not have metabolic B12 deficiency, the serum B12 has to be above 400 picomoles per liter, which I think translates in U.S. units to something similar like 370 or 425. It's in mm-hmm. that ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is that in our hospital and in many others, the so-called normal range is from 160 to 600. So within the normal range or the reference range are many people with metabolic B12 deficiency.
Uh-huh.
And this not only, B12 deficiency not only raises homocysteine levels and increases the risk of deep vein thrombosis and stroke and from atrial fibrillation, it also causes neuropathy, spinal cord damage, this is subacute combined degeneration, and dementia.
Uh-huh.
And there's also a recent paper from Robert Clark and Helga Refsum at Oxford about cognitive decline with B12 levels in the low normal range. So the word normal does not mean the same as adequate or sufficient when you're referring to serum B12 levels. It just means that the 95% of the population on either side of the mean. It has to be well up at the higher end of normal to be safe.
Well, that's good advice. Would you rate your research effort, your hypothesis as an instructive failure? And what lessons are you taking from it?
First thing is that I've been stopping high-dose vitamins in virtually all my patients, because with folic acid fortification of the grain supply in North America, just about everybody now has adequate serum folate levels.
Mm-hmm.
I think that our study is telling us that high-dose B vitamins are probably toxic in people with renal failure or significant renal impairment. They're not telling us that homocysteine is harmless, and what this study is going to do in our group is make us focus harder on non-vitamin approaches to lowering homocysteine levels in patients with renal impairment. And we've done some work using thiol drugs with sulfide bonds that bind homocysteine and make it more dialyzable and more excretable in the urine. And we found that probably the most effective thiol for doing that is Mesna, which is a drug that has been used in the past basically to prevent cystitis from chemotherapy drugs. And we haven't got the right regimen yet for dialysis patients, but we have published a study showing that Mesna significantly reduced homocysteine levels in patients on hemodialysis. So this paper is going to give us more impetus to pursue that issue.
Well, Dr. Spence, I want to thank you for your time today, and I wish you luck on your next efforts.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. I hope you found the conversation useful. You can reach us at 1-617-440-4374. And earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano, and I'm Joe Elia. Please join us next time. Thanks for listening.